democracy has nothing to do with freedom. Democracy is a soft variant of communism, and rarely in the history of ideas has been taken for anything else. If the right to vote were expanded to 7-year-olds, its policies would most definitely reflect the, quote, legitimate concerns of children to have, quote, adequate and, quote, equal access to, quote, free French fries, lemonade, and videos. Hans Hermann Hoppe, in The Paradox of Imperialism and in Democracy, the God That Failed.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right. So welcome back to another episode of Court is in Session, or not really a new episode, as much as this is an addendum to the old one. So just last week, Francois Delecto interviewed me about the Chicago School of Economic Thought. And after listening to it, one of our longtime listeners from the very beginning, Mr. Lewis Gear, texted me and he said, that was a good episode, but pretty much everything that you said about the Austrian school was wrong. So to that end, I've invited him onto the podcast to tell me everything that I said wrong about the Austrian school. And if any of y'all take umbrage with anything that I say on the podcast, you're more than welcome to come on and correct me. So, Mr. Gear, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Portland, it is such a treat. After a long hiatus with a good friend of ours, Alec, filling in for me, it is wonderful to be back. Yes. And I'm excited for my next opportunity to speak with Francois. I think you and I could do a dual interview on him about one of his many interests, maybe monarchism. He can try and justify monarchism.
It'd be fine.
Oh, he's also one of the people that argues that the British Empire was good for the world. So that would be a good topic for us. But I'm here because I feel like you made some errors in your last episode.
All right. Well, just let's jump right in. I guess, firstly, what was the most egregious thing, that egregiously wrong thing that I said about the Austrian school?
So I feel like I don't know if you necessarily got something totally wrong, but I think there was a couple misperceptions. I would say it was also a good one in the middle was Francois had mentioned that Hoppe had called the Mount Pelerin Society a socialist club. And you responded with how you what your reaction to that was. But I just wanted to mention that at the first meeting of the Mount Pelerin Society, Ludwig von Mises stormed out of one of the discussions and saying back to them, you're all a bunch of socialists.
Did he really?
Yes, at the first Mount Pelerin Society meeting.
This has been something from the beginning.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Was it because Milton Friedman was there? Is it kind of like okay. I didn't know if it was like during, kind of an
it was during
Ayn Rand
a discussion. It was during a discussion on income inequality.
Okay.
And I guess something in the discussion. This I saw this from a video. Milton Friedman was retelling the story himself. And he said, well, Mises just got up and said to us that we're all a bunch of socialists and then stormed out. So that's what happened, as Milton Friedman told it. And then related to what you were about to talk about was the Ayn Rand thing. And I wanted to kind of give a small correction that Ayn Rand's objection to the Friedman article or pamphlet on rent control, her main objection was that to even consider this as a reasonable proposition is already giving away to the game. There essentially shouldn't be room to talk about this when the assumption underlying the premise is that you're going to steal someone's property. So that was her objection.
So it wasn't so much that you're thinking about people as a whole or the economy as a whole, that's a socialist ideal. It's the fact that you're even giving any airtime to thinking to consider, to considering rent control like a reasonable idea at all that can be talked about and argued about, it should just be immediately dismissed as this is robbery and this is wrong, and having a full economic analysis on it is socialist. Is that a fairer characterization of it?
I think that's the spirit of it, I would say.
Okay.
I think they might be able to explain it more rationally, of course, but I think that's the spirit of it, that you're giving away too much ground already to even treat it as a legitimate proposition.
We love Ayn Rand.
that's a top 10 poggers moment for Ayn Rand. And I wanted to give a little bit of commends. I personally believe that the greatest achievement of the Chicago School is, as you mentioned, the Chicago boys helping out Pinochet.
Yeah.
I think that's a crowning achievement.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit more on the previous podcast, but I know that Francois wanted to keep it short. But that's such a fascinating thing, was the Chicago boys kind of taking over the Chilean economy. And they've been under the same constitution since 1988. I just found this out today. And they just voted against revising their old constitution because they liked the economic system that was formed. So
I was in a bar last night and I was reading an exact article about that topic.
So it's kind of funny, because as much as Pinochet was a dictator and was a horrible militaristic politician, he did institute a good system of economy for Chile that's been, as far as South America is concerned, they've been doing all right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to be so harsh on Pinochet, but I think you're correct. And it's apparently an influence that's still standing. I kind of chuckled when I saw that it's the same constitution that he set up. And I was like, geez, yeah. I figured that after the coup, they would have just had a new constitution. That would have just been part of the procedures, but I guess not.
I was surprised at that too. I've never heard of
it. It was a resounding majority. I think it was like over 70% voted no. On accepting,
I don't think it was
economy.
That high. I think it was.
No?
I think it was
like in the 60s.
I think it was in the 60s. Yeah, okay, it was like 60. 66 or 33 or something like that. But two thirds of the people
that's
of
strong.
Chile wanted.
That's strong.
Yeah. Oh, huge. Yeah. Bernie Sanders was all butthurt about it.
Was he really? He was tweeting about it.
Yeah.
Well, that guy's a fucking communist anyway. So
fair.
He doesn't have a say in whatever's going on. And then, did you see that there was an assassination attempt on the vice president of Argentina?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, well, that's funny, because the Argentinian politics are so corrupt that she was a former president who I believe had to resign or was arrested because of corruption and bribery charges. And she was convicted, I think.
Oh, wow.
And then she was like, well, I want to be president again, but I think there'll be too much controversy if I run for president, so I'll just run with a puppet guy for president, and I'll be vice president, and I'll actually control the whole thing. And that's what's been going on.
Wow.
Yeah. Apparently, though,
Donald Trump will puppet here.
Apparently, though, there is a strong libertarian presence in Argentina that is expected to actually do kind of decently in their next elections.
Okay. Good for
that
them.
It's not impossible, even. It might be very difficult, but it's not impossible to conceive that one of the Libertarian Party candidates could win the president position.
What does a Libertarian in Argentina look like in comparison to an American Libertarian? Do you know?
I think they look like you and me. I think they have two eyes, two arms, two legs. But I would also say that they're probably less autistic than we are.
Okay.
I like to think that these are like next generation Christophers of Columbus. You know, they're just these great men.
Fair. Okay.
That's a positive image I have for them. And they're also really passionate, and they also go to the extreme. They have shit that's more extreme than the Beltway libertarians here. That is like part of their movement by default.
Yeah, and we need more of that spirit in American libertarianism. Like what the Cato Institute, I don't know. They're just trying to be liberals now. Like they I
Well, Murray Rothbard was a co-founder of the Cato Institute, quit, left his position because he declared that they had gone too far left. That was
Well,
in like the 80s or 90s, I think.
but also left of Murray Rothbard is different than what Cato is now. I mean, left of Murray Rothbard is, you'd still be pretty far right. I think I'm probably left of Murray Rothbard.
Yes, but you're to
Actually,
the right of the Cato Institute.
I am to the right of the Cato Institute. That's my point. It doesn't, I'm saying it doesn't take much to be to the left of Murray Rothbard.
Don't think so, but I think just in the case of the Cato Institute, they have a lot more
Yeah.
in common with some of the progressives of the political paradigm currently than they do some more conservative people.
It certainly seems that way for sure. It seems like they're courting the left, and I don't really think that's the proper way forward for libertarianism.
I've heard the idea discussed before that you can apply the term progressive to even non-left entities. So I think there's this guy named Brian McClanahan. He's like a historian. He has said he has called the neoconservatives progressive because they have like he defines progressivism partly as being a world viewing ideology that you focus on the whole world more than the country, and you want our politics to be more involved with world politics, and that's part of progressivism for both. Because if you look back at the Wilson era progressivism and FDR era progressivism, they were both technically imperialists of wanting to go into those world wars, of being more involved, setting up the what the fuck did Wilson want to set up? League of Nations. He wanted to set up League of Nations, international organization after FDR, the UN. Same idea. Then that's how the neoconservatives are too, right? Because they want us to have these military bases. It's a bit of a harder power, but they want us to have all these military bases across the world. So he thinks that, it's reasonable to call them both progressives in a sense.
I think that's probably, I'd say that's probably reasonable. It all depends on how you define these terms, you know? Like I've heard progressivism described as just this idea that humanity keeps getting better. Which I think is a, I think we probably discussed this. And I guess in that way, you could call me a progressive in that I do think the world does seem to continually get better with little bumps in the road, but that's not, I don't know.
Okay, so I would not go that. I would not call myself a progressive. Just to stat that out, Lewis Gear is in no way a progressive. I think that maybe we could be going in okay positions, but I don't know if I believe in any overarching story to human history. So, like the Whig theory of history, where they kind of believe that everything is an eternal arc towards more freedom. Maybe. I think it's just very also very possible that we could just, at what point do bumps in the road not become bumps in the road is part of the problem. At what point does that just prove that no, we're just being reset or set back, and this isn't just continuing on the eternal path? And then you get this Marxist theory of history, which is the inevitable story towards socialism, right? So
I don't
from, yep, go
know.
ahead.
Like the Marxist theory of history, I don't. Well, I don't. We probably agree on this, so I won't get into too much of a rabbit trail. But I think that's been largely disproven. I think you would have seen, either you would have seen somewhere, an example of socialism actually working. And there's been not just like the Soviet Union falling, but I think more of these African countries, that are really, in the post-liberated Africa. They've really followed a lot of these socialist ideologies to the letter, and yet, despite being the most, resource-rich continent in the country, they are continuously the poorest. And this is something that Magat Wade talks about a lot, is how socialism. Anyway, that was just a totally rabbit trail, but it got me thinking about it because I've been listening to Magat Wade recently.
I think you're right. And then plus these African nations are being the victims of predatory like practices by all these international Western organizations.
Yeah. And Eastern organizations, because China's really been going after
China too.
Yeah.
Being like, hey, we built this bridge for you. That means we own you now, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So back to kind of steering us back to the original topic.
Well, hold on. I'll try and work on a better segue back to what we were talking about.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, so basically, I would say also, I find the history of these different economic schools to be very interesting. That's part of the enjoyment to me of these ideas are the people behind them. Right. And so I like knowing about what their relationships were and how they interacted with each other. And so I appreciated the moments when you were trying to go through the history of the two schools. And I didn't look up to see, and I did not prior knowledge know, where the Chicago school came from. I think you can probably track its same lineage back to the starting point of the Austrian school, but I don't know if the Chicago school came from the Austrian school like directly. At a certain point, there were like a couple branching off points in the Austrian school. And I obviously have the most, and the most popular one, and the one that I follow the most, is the trail from Mises to Hayek and Rothbard to Hoppe, in that whole train. Whereas there's other people in the Austrian school as well.
A good question. Like you were talking, and you got me thinking, because I know generally the almost kind of grandfather of the Chicago school is Aaron Director, who taught at the University of Chicago when Milton Friedman was a PhD student there and eventually married Aaron Director's daughter. And they all at the University of Chicago kind of started the Chicago school. But I don't – was Aaron Director an Austrian economist? I really don't know.
I don't know.
So that might be kind of when it started.
That's possible. I know that at least for the Austrian school, the Austrian school is kind of old. I believe it was started around or by the work of the economist Eugene von Bahlwerk, who's a Central European economist. And he was going through or was the product of the marginalist revolution. In economics, which was this revelation in this period, I think it's like the 1800s or 1700s. I honestly am not that good with dates, but this sort of period for these economists in Europe where they developed the subjective theory of value and started to apply it to world economics and then tracing its history and trying to understand where it came from, what's the justification for it, where it's going to go, and all that stuff. And it was the realization that, you know, even great economists in the past, like Adam Smith, believed in a labor theory of value. They believed that, you know, the desk would get its value based on how much work went into it, how long it took.
Right.
And in the marginalist revolution with the subjective theory of value, it came the realization and the justifications that no, it's not necessarily just what labor goes into making this chair. It's what the actual person that's buying it is willing to pay for it. What they think it's worth. If they don't think it's worth anything, then it doesn't even matter how much work the guy put into it. It's not going to sell. And what it sells for is actually what it's worth.
Right.
So it was this big realization that then leads them to making, you know, further conclusions and theories and stuff that spiraled into eventually the founding of the Austrian school. And then of course, Mises, Hayek and the rest.
Huh.
That's my understanding. Yes. And obviously the huge, and then they try and talk about proto-Austrian. So people before the marginalist revolution. And one of the people that they actually tie back to is St. Thomas Aquinas. They say that he wrote a lot on economic subjects and on social subjects. And in these areas, it seems like he's actually talking about some of the same concepts as what is later developed in the marginalist revolution about value and the economy.
Really?
Yep. I believe that's correct. Yep. I believe so.
Well, that's fascinating. St. Thomas Aquinas never gets the recognition outside of Catholic circles that I think he deserves. Because he really brought Aristotelian thought, I think, into the mainstream Catholic ideology, which of course was dominant at the time that he was writing.
Yeah. So I actually have this thing. It's the History of Austro-Libertarian, which is like the Mises. You also talked about how you kind of said that in the Austrian school, they'll combine the economic and political. And right. I think some people do that. I don't think that that's – I think that there's plenty of Austrian work out there and Austrian scholars that are just focused on the economics, where they really don't talk about the social or the political that much. I just think that you're correct that you see more of that blending in the Austrian school than in the Chicago school, but that's not the entirety of the Austrian school.
So you think that's a little bit of a mischaracterization, that at its heart, it is still an economics school.
Yes. At the heart, it is still an economics profession. They just believe that the economics and how we treat these private property rights that lead into economics then lead into, you know, the working social groups, and then, you know, figuring out which social groups are the best and which political, which systems of politics get us to the best economic situation is what more of their focus is, I would say. And so then that's where you get, you know, the work of, even from Mises, he talked about the social and the political, but at the core of it, it was just the economics. And then there's also this mischaracterization of, oh, the Austrians hate math, right? You've heard this before. Right. They hate equations.
I have heard that.
They don't do math. None of their work ever includes math. That's completely wrong. They include math a lot. They just believe that a lot of the work that's being put out now are these complex models that exist to just exist. And anytime you try to take them into the real world, they just fall apart. And they're not.
Well, that's
what?
Yeah. Well, no, that's 100% the truth. And that's like my one biggest takeaway from grad school is that this brand of economics where you just try to see the entire world through these equations is wrong and verifiably wrong. And my professor, who was one of the people that wrote REMI, the biggest and most used economic modeling software ever, said that a educated guess by most economists worth their salt and some that aren't, would be better about three times as often, more accurate three times as often than REMI software would be. But it's just about, let's have these really complicated models that only we can understand. And that way, when we say something, you have to believe it, because what else are you supposed to believe? And that is one of the biggest problems that I see with the modern economist. And then those are the same people that are making fun of Austrians for never using math, which, again, they use math quite often. But it doesn't come from this same arrogant, you know, we need to figure out a way to exclude people from the market by using really complicated math, which I think has really ruined the profession.
Yeah,
maybe it's this whole, is the right word.
It's this whole fetish that there is for behavioral economics.
Yeah.
Just like giving in that book called Nudge. It's like, if we just turn the valve ever so slightly, then we can just have exactly what we want. It's always going to function this way. The models prove it. And it's just like, and that's something that I think you might have mentioned, this is that the Austrians just considered to be arrogant.
Yeah.
They're just saying, no, it doesn't matter what these damn models say, because we have a priori knowledge about how we actually deal with each other. We can just look at how we deal with each other, look at history.
Yeah.
We don't need these models to just make up what we want to make up. And that's,
and
you know, it's, yeah.
Well, and Mercatus talks about this a lot. Their big thing is that it seems a lot of economists like to think of, quote, the economy as one thing, as one big input and output thing. And that's like the main theory behind modern monetary theory, is that the economy is one thing that you can pump money into and you can tax money out, and it's the economy. But Mercatus talks about, and I have so much respect for Mercatus, and they drive this hard to everything they do, that no, the economy is a loose collection of all the individuals on Earth, and each individual is rational. Each individual makes decisions for himself, and you can't treat them as if they're all one thing, thinking only about the collective, because people are going to rationally do what's best for them. And input-output models and all of these other fancy mathematical equations that modern economists come up with never take that into account, because it would simply be too difficult. So you have to assume that everybody's going to act as a collective, and that's where you really run into trouble. And that's something that the even like the neoclassicals are guilty of, and that's something that the Austrians have nailed down for a long time, and I think continues to make them a really good school of thought.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Anyway, sorry, I'm passionate about that one.
No. I think you're exactly right. So then people just don't think that the Austrians like to do math, because they have this criticism of what we were both talking about, which just isn't accurate. But I want to correct something. I mentioned Baum Bawerk earlier about having a role in the marginal evolution. I want to say that I had forgotten Karl Menger, who is considered a founder of the subjective theory of value. And he was at the same time as Baum Bawerk, but just slightly earlier. They both operated in the second half of the 1800s.
Okay.
That's when they both operated. Menger, subjective theory of value, and then Baum Bawerk was, you could think of as like one of the first starting points of a developed Austrian school, and then laying out some of their main theories.
Now, was any of this, would you say that any of this contributed to kind of the advent of the Industrial Revolution? I mean, these were, you know, mid-1800s folks in Europe. And if the answer is you don't know, that's totally fine. But I'd be interested in knowing if any of those kind of lent themselves to the Industrial Revolution.
I think that is wonderfully optimistic about how much influence that these guys had. I think they were surprisingly popular. Like, this was back in an age of, like, you know, obviously, like, as old fashioned as you can get, of men in suits all the time and smoking cigars and talking about politics and philosophy for 7 hours on a Sunday afternoon. Right. You know, that was the era that these people existed in. And these guys, being professors at top universities in their countries, were going to get them pretty high up in like the social hierarchy and social aristocracy. So some of these people did have connections to some royalty groups. I know that much. But more than that, I don't know if they could plan, you know, the Industrial Revolution or anything. I think it was just they happened to be around. I think also we could probably look at is how they saw the economy developing under the Industrial Revolution could have given them some ideas about, oh, this is actually just how the economy works. And now we're just reaching stages of development and prosperity where it's coming to rise for obvious viewing.
Mm.
So I think that might be possible, because then, of course, Marx existed at the same time, but he felt like that what he was seeing with the Industrial Revolution was validating his concerns about capitalism.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the people they claim, they actually started Aristotle for the Austrian school, Austro-Libertarian school.
Right.
Aristotle, Aquinas, John Locke, of course, Menger, Baum Bawerk, Mises, Hayek, and then they actually put Ayn Rand on here. I think that's nice. That's cute. Yeah. Putting Ayn Rand in here. Because I think, I mean, 100% she had Austrian economics. Like everything, all that she operated under all the same economic paradigms as Mises and Rothbard and Hayek. Maybe sometimes Hayek, but definitely Mises. 100% Mises. Right. And I think she credited Mises in some of her books.
Really?
As where she got a lot of her economic, not a lot, but where she got her economic thing from. And then, of course, she considers, I think she says that there's only like three good philosophers or something. I think she says it's Aristotle, Aquinas, and then somebody else. And that's exactly the same people that the Austrians focus on.
Right.
So, and then Rothbard is, oh yeah, you said Rothbard, you said like Rothbard might have been an ANCAP or something. He 100% was an ANCAP.
Okay.
That's just a nitpick. That's an insane autistic nitpick. But I just wanted to say that your suspicion was right. Like it made it seem like that you weren't confirmed or whether or not he was an anarcho-capitalist, but he 100% was.
Okay.
I just want to clear that up. But not every Austrian is an ANCAP.
No, for sure.
Yeah, obviously these Austro-libertarian, like Mises was not an anarcho-capitalist. None of those guys were. Like none of those guys from the 1800s are going to be ANCAPs.
Right.
Some people like Lysander Spooner, you know, around the same time. But those guys were old-fashioned European aristocracy men.
Right.
You know, they were royalists. 100%. That's kind of what makes them so cool, I think, as well. Because, you know, they're not just these democracy guys. Ludwig von Mises was a democracy guy, 100%. Hayek, as Francois mentioned a little bit, you know, Hayek kind of liked the monarchy a little bit. He got a little bit fancy with it sometimes. I think that's why he liked his time in England so much.
Right. That makes sense.
And then of course, Ayn Rand, very famously a minarchist. Rothbard, ANCAP, and then Hans Hermann Hoppe, for as many of the jokes that go around, is an ANCAP. He's 100% an ANCAP. He's not anything else but that. He just likes to play with the ideas. And then his main misconception is that people are I'm sure you've heard of this. People associate him with monarchy or like new monarchism or something. That was just in his book, The Democracy of the God That Failed, where he was just talking about the ideas. And he says, he thinks that monarchism in history has been shown to be a better system of government than democracy. But he's not saying that he would want to live in a monarchy. He's saying he's still an ANCAP. He'd still rather live in an anarchist society, but he thinks that monarchism is a better system than democracy.
Makes sense.
At least that's one thought experiment he had. So, and this is, of course, completely alien thinking to anybody in the Chicago school. I don't know how many Chicago economists are ANCAPs. That would be an interesting research project for you, Cortland.
That would be.
To see how many of those people take it all the way. I imagine that you
can. My guess is not many. It would be hard to, because they're also mostly monetarists.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yep.
So unless you had just a totally private central bank that somehow everybody agreed to, but like, I don't know. That'd be a tough one. And maybe I'll look into it. And maybe I'm mischaracterizing the Chicago school a little bit. But I think they tended to be something, and I mentioned this in the last episode, they tended to be an easier pill to swallow than the Austrian school has always been. Because the Austrian school does kind of have some characters in it, for better or for worse. It does have some
characters. Fun characters. People are fun.
Oh, yeah.
But I also think that the reason why the Chicago school is seen as more respectable is because that's the attitude that they've tried to have. Because they were already, you know, Milton Friedman, you're so wacky. You're so wacky with your little idea about reducing the size of government, but you got to still have some role for the government in the economy.
Right.
The Keynesians are going to like having that. Because the economics departments in the university American system are Keynesian.
Yeah.
They are. There's very, very few that aren't. George Mason, Chicago School, which by my measure, only slightly better than the Kazines, but they're not, you know, I don't actually, are they still in control of the Chicago, the Econ Chicago department?
No, actually, I think the University of Chicago has gotten pretty liberal. They like there are still vestiges with it, but they've definitely lost their really solid grasp on the university that they had in like the '80s. And it's the same with the law school too. Like, it's still the best place to study law and economics, but it doesn't define the place. As it does with like a George Mason University. And when I say law and economics, like as a discipline, that is really the translation of the Chicago school into the legal field more so than just like, oh, let's talk about how law and economics intercepts. Like that's a pretty well understood definition of when you're talking about law and economics, but it's they've lost their grasp pretty well in the University of Chicago. Like they're still around, but most of the people just got old and died.
Yeah, so then actually that leads perfectly into the ending discussion that you had with Francois, where I was surprised, slightly surprised to hear that you think the Austrian school has more momentum going forward than the Chicago school does.
I do, yeah. It sounds like you disagree.
No, I don't know if I disagree. I am just a pessimistic person by nature. But I would have to think that by everything that I'm seeing, the Chicago school is not the force that it was. And I think while the Austrian school has never been an upfront like force, like the Chicago school was for a little bit at the University of Chicago, there's no like, I don't know, like it'd be like if FSU had like the Austrian school, like at FSU, like, right. this is a school where you're going to get the Austrian opinion on economics that controls the entire economic profession at the school and not just Keynesians and whatever. Whereas Austrian's just been more a softer path. So they're just getting in more professors in the different fields that you talked about, like historians and social sciences and stuff. There's not a lot of younger kids.
So it sounds like you're agreeing with the...
Yes, I think you're correct. But I think I'm just pessimistic about the success of either school in actually changing, you know, the situation in any capacity.
Well,
like, I don't know.
You said it yourself.
Go ahead.
You said it yourself. The libertarians in South America are making a comeback that is surely pushed by the Austrian school.
Ron Paul. That his campaign was Austrian.
Yeah,
there wasn't anything in his economics that weren't Austrian. But when we think of Cato and we think of Reason Magazine and the Reason Foundation, I think those are Chicago institutions.
I think they're a bastardization of the Chicago institution. I think you're painting the Chicago school as more liberal than it really is. Maybe you're right. But I still think Cato leans to the left of the Chicago school.
No, I mean, I think you're right. Do you think left? Are you saying left in terms of social, political, or economic? Political as in roles of the government, economic as in regulations, and social as in gay stuff.
Yeah. Certainly socially. It leans left to the Chicago school because, like, just
okay,
talking
can I,
about
–
sorry.
Let me ask it a different way. Do you think more people at Cato – believe that there should be a Fed or believe that there should not be a Fed?
Probably more people at Cato. That's a good question, but probably more people at Cato. I mean, wow, that's a great question because they have a whole center about monetary alternatives. And I think that's based around ending the Federal Reserve. And that's probably most would say that they want to get rid of the Federal Reserve, more so than would say they want to keep
Wow.
it. I'd say so, yeah.
Wow. That's shocking. That's shocking. I disagree. I disagree. I think there are way more people that believe that there should be a Fed, or they don't even give it the thought.
That's probably a lot of
Which
them.
is worse, which is worse.
Yeah.
It's worse. You cannot be at an avowedly free market, a principally free market think tank. That's what Cato was, principally free market think tank. And not have any opinion about one of the biggest debates in economics about this country.
I don't know if that's a fair characterization of Cato, though, because they do put effort into that. They have a whole center dedicated to that, where they talk about just monetary policy.
I
And
can see that.
I'm not sitting here trying to defend Cato,
No,
but I
no, no,
think,
no, no.
like I think Cato's probably, I'd still put Cato up there as one of the best, most principled think tanks in Washington, like
No,
major think tanks.
I'm happy that they exist. I am not like upset that they exist. I think it's a better thing that they are here.
Yeah. But I think so. Also, to our conversation that we were having before about momentum within the Austrian school, I think you can also point to what just happened in the Libertarian Party of the United States with the Mises Caucus taking over. And you know, I had to bring that up
I
because
mean,
who's more principally Austrian than, who's more principally Austrian than Dave Smith?
of course. That's a good point. That's a good point. I think it's very possible. I think the I but I would want to say, just to give clarification, the Mises Institute is not involved in any way with the Mises Caucus.
No, that's true.
Because they're a 501c3 operation. They cannot get involved in politics directly. It's just that Dave Smith, who is associated with both, is heavily involved in the Mises Caucus, and then they just get their inspiration from the same person, Ludwig von Mises.
Yeah.
Although I would say, sometimes the Mises Caucus guys, they pog it up a little bit too much. I think they got the right spirit, but I think a lot of them assume that they kind of go overboard sometimes. We think of the Cato Institute and the Reason Foundation and these people, the Beltway Libertarians, as focusing too much on being respectable.
Right.
They focus too much on being invited to the cocktail parties and like supposedly talking to the right people or whatever. But I think that some people in the Mises Caucus are swinging too far the other way, where they think that, oh, you don't have to be respectable because what we're saying is correct, what we're saying
Right.
is right, and I think it's going to burn some of them, because you can't just go up lecturing somebody if they just went through something.
Right.
You got to know how to speak to people, and that was the beauty of Ron Paul, is that he
Yeah.
was this very nice Southern gentleman. Everybody, not everybody knew him, but people knew him.
Yeah.
Nobody had anything ever bad to say about him. He was an OBGYN doctor for decades.
Yeah.
This is real great man. And that was part of the reason why he could get away with saying the stuff that he was saying,
Yeah.
is that
He
you
told, he
had
called
to
some.
go ahead.
Sorry. No, that's all you.
No, I was going to say that he even people could not call him like a crazy guy. Even people that
Yeah.
hated him, you couldn't say, no, this guy's insane. You could just not like his ideas, but you can't be looking at this guy and be like, oh yeah, this guy's off his rockers or anything.
Yeah. He managed to call somebody a fat ass on one of his shows in the most polite way I've ever seen.
Jimmy, roll the clip.
Maybe I can find a way to download that and put it on this show. That was that
That'd be
because that
funny.
is a
Some of
beautiful
your
scene.
expert editing.
Oh yeah, that's me. Yeah.
But
And I
yeah,
just don't see a figure like that anymore because Ron Paul or Rand Paul's he's abrasive, you know? He's not, I love him to death, but he's just isn't that same kind Southern gentleman that Ron was.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think he's just also, I agree, but I don't see that as a necessary negative. Okay. I think he could be nice when he wants to, but he still has a little bit of fire in him. I just don't think he's as able to put things maybe so simply, or he's not able to just frame things in the same way that Ron Paul is able to frame things.
Yeah.
And I don't think he has the same persistence that his father does. But then again, you know, we don't know how Ron Paul would have handled in a debate with Donald Trump. I think it would have just come off as, oh man, this guy's yelling at my grandpa.
Yeah.
That's how people would have viewed the debate. Like, why is Donald Trump being so mad at my papa?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think you're right. It's going to be a while before we get somebody like that. But we might be at the stage where that's not the person, not to be, you know, retarded about it, but that's not the person that we need anymore.
Right.
Maybe we need somebody that's a bit harsher.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe we need a little bit more of these forceful South American libertarian people. And then Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil does some wacky things sometimes.
Does.
Yeah. But I would not say he's a libertarian. But what's funny about him, I believe, reading at the initial start of his administration, is that he was so focused on being this populist person and kind of just going by personality and all this other stuff that he sort of had the same situation when Trump came into office, where apparently Trump didn't give a lot of thought to how he's going to fill all these bureaucratic positions.
Right.
And apparently Bolsonaro was in kind of the same boat, but he was somehow persuaded into just giving a decent amount of the economic functions of government over to these more libertarian people.
Nice.
Yeah. So, which is just kind of, you know, it's like, well, you know, maybe we could have this right populist figure that's a little bit wacky sometimes, but what if we do actually make good improvements on property rights or, you know, regulation or just the functioning of the economy in general under this guy?
Right.
Could that be a W? Could it not be a W? I think that's also a question that divides the libertarian sphere.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And then, you know, but there's divisions, you know, even in the respectable parts of economics, like between the Chicago and Austrian schools, they both hate, I would say the Austrian school hates the Keynesians. I think the Chicago boys, I don't know. Did you get the sense that they hated the Keynesians, or they were saying that the Keynesians were wrong and they knew that they were wrong, or that the Keynesians were wrong, but they were just misguided?
The Chicago boys, like the Chilean folk?
No. The Chicago
school. Oh, Chicago school.
Yeah.
I think there was a sense that the Keynesians were wrong and that they knew they were wrong. They're just not the type to go and call them idiots. I don't think they're going to call anybody idiots. And Milton Friedman said that all the time. I'm not going to doubt the intentions of somebody, but I think they're wrong, and I think they know they're wrong.
Damn. Okay. That's bad. Okay. You just corrected a misperception from me about the Chicago school.
You thought that they thought they were acting in goodwill?
Like, yes.
They thought the Keynesians were just simply – okay.
Messing up the math somehow.
No. I don't think it was anything like that.
Okay. Okay. That's good. And then I think the Austrians would go farther and say the Keynesians are wrong. They know that they're wrong, and that makes them evil.
Yeah. That's a very good point. And I don't think a Chicago person would call anybody evil like that. Mm. And I think part of it was they found it a better way to communicate and get through to people. And part of it was that they, again, liked being invited to these daggum cocktail parties that are apparently the be-all and all of a happy life.
Oh, man.
Well, Mr. Gear, we have been talking about this far longer than the original podcast episode was.
It's like those YouTube videos where it's an 8-hour video dissection about a 1.5-hour movie.
Yeah, exactly. This was certainly one of those situations, but for the mental health of our poor listener, we should probably think about cutting it right around here. But is there anything else that you can think off the top of your head that I plainly stated incorrectly that you want to address?
I think you were correct in where you were coming from. I think you had the general sense about these two schools, and I think you just got some of the facts messed up. You're a smart man. And if I ever had a question about the Chicago school, you would be the person that I would go to have anything cleared up.
Well, thank you. That's incredibly flattering, and I appreciate it. You're a smart man too. And anytime that I have questions about the Austrian school, I would come to you. Not that Alec guy though, gross.
No, that guy's an amateur.
Yeah, for sure. And again, thank you for coming on. And if anybody else, like I said, anybody listening wants to come on the show and correct anything that I've said, you're more than welcome. I think it's a good way to grow academically. And yeah, thanks again for coming on, Lewis.
Of course.